Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in. Because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm the Big Mike.
Mike Zlatnik, and today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome Mario Dottilo. Hey, Mario.
Hey, Mike. How's it going, man? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming on a podcast. Mario is a specialist in the manufactured home parks. He's been doing this since 2014. Yep. And Mario, would you be so kind just to give us a little bit an introduction about you, kind of how much business you've done, how much AUM you have, and then we'll go back. One of the immediate questions that kind of hits the mind, what's the difference between manufactured home and mobile home parks? First, Mario, where do you live? A little bit about you and then your history, track record, et cetera.
Yeah, I got started in this industry. I live in Naples, Florida. Got started in this industry about 2013 is when we tied up our first manufactured home community. I didn't start out in that world. I actually started out in the single family business back in 2006. I had a real estate brokerage and a mortgage company in Minnesota with a partner. And the market tanked in 2008. I was helping a ton of investors buy like single families and flip them. And then I dispo it on the back end for them. And I went to my dad, who was in construction for his whole life, commercial and residential, said, look, we should be buying these. I'm helping these guys make all this money. We should just be buying these ourselves. And you do the rehab, I'll do the acquisitions and dispo. And from about 2008 to 2012, 13, we did a lot of single family home flips, bought notes, all kinds of distressed real estate in that time. And then we decided we want to get into passive income, right? Or at least consistent cash flowing assets. And so we went towards the direction of apartment buildings just because it was, something that we were familiar with coming from single family, and stumbled across a mobile home park, bought that deal, and nothing's ever been the same. Pretty much been pursuing mobile home park investments, self-storage, small bay light industrial, some RV parks. Yep.
So you got a little bit of diversification, not just manufactured homes. You've got, as you said, self-storage, RV parks. So what's the difference between manufactured and mobile home?
Yeah, so it's a technicality. The term manufactured home started in 1976 when HUD code went into place, and mobile homes or trailers, as what people still call them sometimes, those weren't under any sort of government code. So the older homes, they weren't built to any standards. And then HUD stepped in and said, we're going to standardize this. You have to meet certain code. And that's in 1976. Anything older than that is technically a mobile home, and anything newer than that is a manufactured home. If you were to put a 1976 and a 1977 next to each other, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference, because it's just purely they've got a HUD stamp on the back and they meet certain code. Yep.
Yeah, I hear this. And I just ask one question on this. So I've seen, in my head, so one is technical definition, of course. Mobile home parks, typically, what is it? RV parks, or it's a little different?
RV parks
are different from the mobile home parks, right?
Correct. Yeah, and people still call it mobile home parks. When you go to any conferences or any industry type events or any industry type collateral, you're always going to see them call it manufactured housing, because they're obviously trying to rebrand and make sure that people aren't thinking about old crappy trailer parks, right, when they hear mobile home park. But the most commonly used term is mobile home park, right? But RV parks are different. Think of mobile home parks as being, a for-profit homeowners association. The owner owns the land, the infrastructure, the common area, and the amenities. The residents own their homes. They pay lot rent, okay? And they live there. It's like, it's multifamily, right? And then when you jump over to the RV side, that is going to be, think of more like hospitality, right? A motel, hotel. Somebody pulls their RV in, camper in, whatever, and they keep it there for a period of time, and then they pull it out. They're still on wheels. It's a much more transient type asset. There are long-term RV parks, but they can still drive out. And it's a very different business. We own both, mostly mobile home parks, but we do own some RV.
Yeah, makes sense. That's a great explanation. It's almost like a hotel. You come in there, you may have a different neighbor in a couple of days, right?
Yes.
Versus the mobile home parks or manufactured home parks, the neighbors are still the same for an extended period of time,
20
and
years.
20 years. So technically they can still be moved, but manufactured homes, they get brought in installed, right? They get connected to sewer, everything else, and they are literally, I mean, that theoretically, they could be moved. Practically, they're there. They are
They're
sort
not very mobile.
of.
Yeah, they're fixed, they're tied down, skirted, they're on blocks. They're pretty permanent. They can be moved, but it's very expensive to move one. An RV, you just hook up and pull out. The manufactured homes, you're going to spend at least $3,000 moving it, and to set it up at the new location, it's going to be, call it, 15 to 20,000. So they're
Expensive to
not very
move
mobile. Yeah.
move the thing.
Right. So most people who own manufactured homes never move that home.
Yeah, it just reminds me sometimes you're on a highway and they try that you see a gigantic truck was moving and it says wide load and it's moving, I guess, that manufactured a mobile home to the new location or either brand newly built or from one to another,
Yeah.
but it's an expensive endeavor to actually make the move.
It is. Yeah. And our fund
So,
has acquired these communities, like I said, for over 11 years. We've probably had less than 10 homes move out of our entire portfolio of over 1,000 lots in that period of time. Very, very rare. Very rare. They always sell to the next buyer. So, if somebody's wants to move, they just list their home, they market it, they find a buyer, they buy it. As a community, we approve that buyer just like an HOA would, and we don't miss a beat on the rent, which is one reason why it is such an attractive investment compared to most other property types. We don't have the turnover costs, we don't have the, make ready, we don't have the downtime that you have in apartments or almost any other property type.
yeah, I got you. So, does your fund own most of the just the land and the infrastructure versus the? Because I've heard sometimes you own some of these homes and you just rent them out.
Yep.
Then it becomes like a multifamily in essence, versus you basically just own the land and the infrastructure, and then every owner is a tenant, like an HOA type of a setup.
Yeah, our communities are almost 100% tenant-owned homes. And so we operate on lot rent and land leases essentially. But there are two business models. There's the rental model and the tenant-owned model. The rental model is the less attractive, harder to finance, harder to market type asset. You might as well just go buy an apartment building because that's what you're buying, but you're buying it with, manufactured homes that are obviously going to take more repair and maintenance than an apartment building. So we have bought communities that were completely park-owned homes, and we've converted that to a lot rent model. Can't do that at every one of them, but the ones that we have bought that way, that was the business model, is convert them. There are some people who continue to run them as rental communities. And in some rural markets, you'll see that is the only way to run it just because the rents are too low to do a lot rent model. But not something I would recommend someone doing unless they really want to have a management intense property. The reason you buy a mobile home park is because you have lower expense ratio than most other property types, right? You maintain a lot less on that asset because you don't have to maintain the units. The tenants do, right? You have ground leases or lot rent. And they're a fairly, I don't want, they're not a passive investment by any means, but they are a lot more boring of a property to manage once they're stabilized than most other property types as well. We have very little turnover. Turnover is less than 10%, typically around 5% per year. If you look at any other property type, with maybe a couple of exceptions, that's very rare. We have, call it two to three, maybe four in a 100 space community move out per year. That's crazy. And we don't have expenses associated with that. So it's a very stable asset to own once they are stabilized.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And so a couple of sort of follow-up questions. So like you said, it's not really passive. It is an active investment. But by the
It is.
same token, like a self-storage, people say it's passive. Well, you still have to manage it. These are These, I guess, it's the same way that people even in the same category. Well, any of these investments, they're not purely passive. I mean, even multifamily community with a lot of work involved. You just have less
Oh,
work
yeah.
involved. So self-storage and manufactured home parks, less work than obviously multifamily and some other active asset classes.
I'll rank them for you, okay? Because
Okay.
I own all of them. Apartments, definitely the most management intense. Then self-storage, then mobile home parks. I would throw RVs above mobile home parks. Okay,
Yeah, I got you.
actually,
Then there's
RV
other
is
ones like
probably side by side with
industrial open air shopping. Those
different,
are a
yes.
lot less, the less management intensive. You're dealing with more sophisticated tenants, probably to the degree similar to yours, except for you are dealing with the companies as tenants versus the individual folks.
Yeah, those type of tenants are going to be a triple net typically, and there's still asset management responsibilities, but not as much property management responsibilities. So you're still negotiating tax, insurance, legal issues, things like that, but you don't have the turnover. You're not negotiating leases every month.
And they're
Those are
long term. Everything
definitely
is long term. And
right.
then, even though you probably your land lease terms are what, annual or monthly, but they most of them, like you said, they stick around for a long time. You may have a monthly rent like a self storage, but people may have the box for 3 years.
Yes. Yes. And I would say self-storage definitely has more turnover than mobile home parks. Mobile home parks are either on an annual lease or they're an annual and then convert to a month to month, but the homes don't move. So again, the tenant might move out, but they're going to sell it to someone else who takes over their lease. We don't miss any rent.
Yeah, I got you. And then I guess you approve the new tenant. Now let's talk about the economic returns in this space. So when you buy these mobile home parks, what kind of returns do you target? What kind of cap rates you buy them at? We're recording this early part of 2025. What are the cap rates today? What kind of cash flows they generate? What kind of target returns? Just curious how this asset class performs. And obviously, very specifically referring to the current market conditions when the interest rates are high, which make
Of
it,
course.
a little bit more difficult to get financing, et cetera.
I'm gonna back up one and I will answer this question, but I want to start out with something else because this will make a lot more sense. My initial answer is always it depends on what you pay, right? Because everybody says, oh, mobile home park, self-storage, it's such, those are cash cows, right? Well, it depends. If you overpay and overleverage, it's gonna be a crap cash flow deal, right? So, but this is why the opportunity in manufactured housing is so attractive right now, and it's not going to stay this way. Okay. It's because there's consolidation happening, and there's really two different things. Number one, extremely high demand for affordable housing. Extreme. We hear about it every day on the news, right? Decreasing supply of these assets. You can't build them. All right. Zoning departments will not allow new construction of mobile home parks in most markets. So you have decreasing supply, increasing demand. We're not worried about competition. Nobody's putting a park in across the street from us, right? So if you own these assets, super valuable, okay? Because they're going away and they're in high demand. Secondly, we have consolidation happening. These communities, if you look at the chart and when all these communities were developed, they were developed between the 1950s and the early 1990s. Nothing after that because zoning laws started getting implemented in most markets. And so the people who developed these communities literally with their bare hands, drudging out lines and everything for their sewer and water, and some of them even still live in these communities, are now retiring and dying. Okay. They have to sell. And they're selling at a time where the market is, not attractive to sell. So there's underlying motivation for them to sell. They're either passing it on to their kids, they're dying, or they're retiring. That's it. Okay. A lot of the kids don't want to touch it. It's not sexy, right? So you've got sellers who have this secret relationship going on, agreement with their tenants. I won't raise rents, but don't expect me to do anything, okay? Meaning I'm not gonna fix, I'm not gonna maintain anything, and in return, I'm gonna keep your lot rents low. That's an unspoken arrangement. And what's happened is the condition of these communities have went down and the rents have stayed abnormally low compared to all other property types. They haven't kept up with inflation. So you've got all these sellers that are willing to sell. They don't even care about a cap rate. They know they need to make $2 million to retire, and that's their number, right? So you go to them, you negotiate a deal. They've left a ton of meat on the bone, a ton of opportunity to force values up. And most of these opportunities are like management strategies, billing back utilities, raising rents, doing CapEx improvements to modernize the community to then bring them to market rents, right? So very predictable business plans that can be implemented to get the value up and create, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there. So now to answer your question, you know, that opportunity isn't going to last long. It's probably 5 years and then it's consolidated. Just like most other property types, you'll be buying from institutional or at least professional owners again. So you're buying at market cap rates, all right? You're not doing that right now. So you kind of got this abnormal opportunity there, but we aren't really looking at going in cap rate, because if your lot rents are $300 and the market is 480 or 550 or 600, you know, our cap rates may be pretty low going in, but within 1 year to 1 to 2 years, we're at a 10 cap stabilized. Our target, to answer your question, our target is to be at a 10% cap rate upon stabilization. And we're buying things that we can stabilize in 1 to 2 years. Okay. Cash on cash return, uniquely positive compared to most other property types, because when we say, hey, we're setting a 7% or an 8% pref or whatever that pref is, we're buying properties that actually hit or exceed that pref in cash flow year one. We're not buying things that accrue pref for multiple years. They actually cash flow very strong because our expense ratios are, call it, you know, 38 to 43% expense ratio when stabilized. So just an answer. Kind
yeah,
of
I appreciate that.
Level.
So let me dissect this a little bit. So stabilize, you have a target of cash on cash, I guess 10% cap rate, which is a great, obviously, target, hard to find in some of the asset classes. Although after the value at work, projects that buy, you know, cheap, unimproved, a lot of upside, it's a typical value at story and a play. Mm-hmm. I assume the tenants don't mind, and how much resistance you get. So they're paying $300 a lot rent today. Are they, you know, capable, both mentally and with their wallet, pay $500 a lot rent? But you take that, but you improve their living conditions. You create, yes, some common, you know, improvements. I kind of think of this, these type of communities where they're used to this and they don't want to change anything, and you can build them a nice playground, something else. They say, my kids are grown up, I don't care about this stuff. Don't just, I just want to pay what I pay. So I'm mm-hmm. just curious how much resistance you get. Do you have to go change the, you know, how much actually
turnover?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we do, we are not the company to go in and just double rents over year over year. That's not us. There are a few groups that have done that and they've ended up on the front page of the paper and on all the news channels, and it's kind of created some issues in the industry. That is not us. We're not slumlords. We'll go in, we'll make the physical improvements first. So they visually see the community changing. We bring in professional management, and then we do start bringing rents to market. And what we have to explain to them and educate them on is, number one, you haven't had rent increases for years, and every other property has around you. Look at the competition. Look at your other options. This is what rents at apartments are going for. This is what rents at other mobile home parks are going for. This is where you're at. We've made the improvements. We're bringing you to market over a period of time, usually over a few years, okay? And here are your competitors. Our competitors, if you'd like to move there, you're welcome to do that, but we're still less expensive and we're a better value than the others. Secondly, they will complain, but at the same time, they realize what's happened. They've lived in a slum, and we do have a little bit of turnover in some scenarios, but it's not as much as you would think, because they know that it's cheap. Where else can you live for $300 a month plus utilities. Now, keep in mind, most of these homes are owned free and clear. So they don't have a mortgage on top of their lot rent. So it is still very inexpensive, even if you're at $500 or $600 a month in lot rent. You can't live anywhere else for that unless it's subsidized by the government.
Yeah, it makes sense. So the strategy makes sense. I guess the you got to buy it right from a retiring owner who is more susceptible to, let's just call it a friendly deal. Versus a professionally owned, maximized type of return type of owners. And we've actually seen and heard, at least I've seen and heard, institutional ownership in some of these communities. Usually they're larger ones. The smaller ones are still mom and pop. And the moment you go larger, institutional capital has found ways to enter that business because of all the things you've described. And there's been some consolidation already happening. Although the smaller community will probably never be a target for institutional money. So that's where you can make private deals, but you're trading at a generally cap rates, you know, meaningfully higher than the larger communities.
We've seen that there's two phases of consolidation, right? You've got the initial consolidation of the smaller professional investors. We're going out, we're buying these assets, right? And we found the business model that makes sense, and we're turning these into professionally run, stabilized, quality investments, right? And then behind that, you have the institutional guys, the REITs, the private equity, the family offices, the insurance companies. Those guys look and they go, huh, these investors have figured out a way to institutionalize this asset. Let's go buy them, right? So they go out and they buy the larger, you know, built up stabilized portfolios. And you are seeing that on the back end, which is a very good thing for us assembling these portfolios, accruing these portfolios, because we have a back end institutional buyer to exit to that will pay a premium cap rate on those assets once they're clean. But they don't want to buy the messy deals because they don't have the operational capacity to stabilize them. We just bought a 130 site community, great market. It's an institutional quality asset. It can be financed through Fannie or Freddie right now. And we bought that at a 4% interest rate for 10 years fixed, non-recourse interest only from a seller.
How did you get that? That's a seller carry, or not a seller carry, but a assumed loan, I assume.
It's a seller finance deal. Yeah.
It's first a seller finance.
Yeah, they financed it, seller financing. And we bought that at a 7%+ cap rate going in. We'll be at over a 10% cap rate stabilized. And that's a 130 site community, pristine quality, just mismanaged old timer that's owned it for a long time. And so those deals are still out there, and it won't be that way forever though. It is consolidating. And like you said, it gets harder and harder to buy large assets over time.
So what kind of target returns, just a high level, you trying to generate on all these assets between the cash flow and the exit? And some of it, of course, is a function of how you sell them. A lot of assumptions based on sales price, and that's where the complexity lies, is, you know, interest rate environment does impact where the cap rates trade, especially consolidation buyers, institutional. The cost of money to buy makes a big difference for them.
Correct. Yeah. So your exit, you're going in and you're going out is going to have a big impact on how you perform on these. But, you know, for example, investor level returns, mid to high teens IRR on a 10-year, which is not easy to accomplish. We have equity multiples of 2+ multiples. And, you know, I would say that cash on cash return of actual distributed cash flow is 7-10% per year. Starting out, we want to be exceeding pref in year one. That's if you look at it this way, the investors who are getting into these are looking for cash flow. IRR is important, you know, cap rate, not so much, at least going in, but they want to get distributions. Otherwise they would buy other asset classes that they can, you know, accrue their pref on, right? So our goal is to hit or exceed pref in year one. Every year after that, we're pushing up. But you know, ultimately people want to be at 10 plus. Typically our deals will buy, stabilize, refinance into long-term non-recourse debt, return as much, if not all, of the capital to the investors. So they're in the deal with us for the long haul, getting distributions with no capital in or very little capital in. So their returns boost, you know, once stabilized.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So it, the value at play, obviously, is a critical component of these all these deals. And
yes,
the value add is a function, of course, of execution on these improvements, rent growth, and makes a lot of sense. And of course, market conditions, what the interest rates at the time of the refi, a lot depends on that. Your debt service coverage ratio, all that math kicks in. And the environment of predictable low interest rate long gone. Well, it feels like it was just the recent past, but it feels like the recent past became pretty old past because the market changed, higher for longer interest rates, and now we are early part of 25, and it feels like the rates are, at least 10-year treasury has been climbing, and where we wind up, will things reverse? We'll see. But at least on a fundamental basis, what I do like about the strategy, at least my comment, this along with like open air shopping, along with industrial, some assets, of course, self-storage if you can buy right. Some assets, even multifamily, if you can buy right. The key question is buy right.
Correct.
You could cash flow from day one. And that's at least creates some downside protection. And then you just do the value add work, you execute, and then see what happens when you exit. And the target returns that you said in the mid-teens into high teens on a long-term basis is not a bad strategy if folks look at this, you know, from a downside protection perspective, right? As long as it's a risk-reward ratio, right? How much risk you're taking versus how much reward. Overall, it's a solid long-term strategy, but then people have to have reasonable time horizon.
Correct.
Are your funds running on a 10-year time horizon? Is it what you generally look at?
We're modeling at a 7 and a 10-year exit. We tell every single LP of ours, you should only get involved in this deal if you're excited to be in it for 10 or more years. Yeah, we're long-term cash flow hold. We are not a 3 to 5 year turnover fund by any means.
I totally, totally understand and support that idea. Most investors who are used to thinking, well, I'll just park my money for a couple of years, and you go into real estate, it's fundamentally doesn't work.
Yes.
The thinking about short-term horizon on a long-term asset like real estate, especially asset that is value add, you have market cycles, you got to have a long-term perspective, otherwise you're in the wrong place per se.
Agreed. Yeah, and I would say too, with this asset class specifically, we won't be able to have the same conversation 5 years from now about the opportunity buying from who we're buying from. And so we want to accumulate as many good assets at great prices. Okay, we're not just buying to buy, but we're building this portfolio and going to hold it for an extended period of time because we know the supply is dwindling more and more each year. You have more communities being torn down by far than you have being built. And so it becomes a more and more valuable asset, especially when it's stabilized, the longer we hold it. So it's a supply and demand factor that's definitely in favor of this asset class over anything else I've ever seen.
Yeah, understood. And that lack of new supply is a critical factor. Like you said, they don't build these communities any longer. The cities and towns hate
they do
mobile home parks because the tax base. I mean, they wind up not getting the tax base that they could if they had something else on that land.
Yes.
In any case, and then it's consuming sewer, it's consuming water, and et cetera, et cetera. From that perspective, it's not the most ideal use for many,
municipalities. Yeah.
Understood. So, Mary, I appreciate your wisdom, your sharing. How would folks reach out? What's the best way to reach out if they want to look at your funds or just ask questions, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. Equitygrowth.net. That's all our asset management and fund management entity. And then MarioDotillo.net if you want to learn about everything else we're doing. I actually have an education company that teaches people how to actively go out and invest in these. And of course, the fund is for people who just want to sit back and collect a check because we're doing all the work. So yeah, happy to help. I'm all over social media. Pretty easy to find.
Thank you, Mary. Appreciate your wisdom. and have a great 2025. Hope it's an awesome year for you for new acquisitions.
Same to you. Thank you for having me on, Mike. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's slot name. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.